Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Deconstructor of Fun podcast. And in this episode, we're going to talk about something that I have no clue of, which is backends. And to educate myself and the audience, we have Rafael Cordoba, a principal developer at Bandai Namco Barcelona, formerly tech lead for Angry Birds 2, where we actually met at Rovio. Rafael, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Mishka. Pleasure to be here. Hope we can explain all this in this podcast.
Yeah, backend for dummies. No, this is at least the first section will be backend for dummies. And then we have Chris Malosian, Chief Executive Officer and co-founder of Heroic Labs, who knows a lot about backends. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me, Mishka. Good to be
welcome,
here.
Welcome back to the podcast. You were here before last year.
With Ethan, yeah.
Yes, let's see if I can do you guys justice. So today we're going to talk about backends as a service, and I'm taking the angle of something that I've experienced in my work as a head of studio, where I was often the one who would sign these backend as a service contracts, and sometimes when you would do M&A, like that was a part of an M&A when you're looking at the backend services of the target company. And I knew very little and still know quite limited about backends, but every time I knew when something failed, when the backend service didn't scale, when as engineer would put, it was spaghetti code, and everything was very much to me like a black box. And so I've spent some time understanding about backends and backend as a service, and this podcast is more meant for people to understand better what backends do, what is a backend as a service, whether you should be investing in building something of your own custom, or whether you should be taking backend as a service, and what are the limitations of these services, what are the drawbacks when you're choosing between different options. So without further ado, let's kick off with the most basic of the basic of the questions. Is like, what does a backend in games actually do? And Rafael, if you'd be willing to start there.
Yes, of course. Let's start answering your question. What is a client? Okay. This is the client. Your device is the client. And the client talks to the backend. Now, the backend is somewhere in a cloud, basically a server. It's in Amazon or Microsoft or Google. There are multiple providers. That client, you will have a game. So I'll give an example. You install a new game, in the App Store, you play some levels, you get some rewards, let's say you get 300 coins. And then you wanna go and upgrade a character. You want to go from level 1 to level 2. So now you have a character level 2, you are at level 5, and you have, 150 coins in your wallet. You wanna be able to actually save and persist that information. So if you decide to uninstall the game, install again, or you get a new phone, or you are playing multiple devices, maybe you have a tablet, you want to be able to transfer that information between all these devices. And this is what we call persistence. It's one of the first functions of a backend. And there are two ways that we can persist things in a backend. There is the easy way, the shortcut, where usually games like hyper casual will choose, where whatever happens on the client or your phone, we just inform this backend and say something like, hey, I have a character that is now level 2, I am at saga level 5, and my wallet now has 150 coins. That backend is not going to know about anything of your game logic. It's just literally going to take that info, save into a database, and doesn't care. That is not good for some of the more casual to mid-core games and hardcore games, because you want people to not be able to cheat, and not manipulate the memory or say, oh, now I have 1 million coins. So the option two is the backend is actually aware of your game design. So it knows that to upgrade a character from 1 to 2, the cost is 100. So it's going to perform that logic on the server and deduct the same amount of coins, from your wallet. So this way the players cannot cheat, and it's more similar to, you know, like I compare to a bank. You go buy something and you pass your phone or your card, then the bank has to say minus 50 euros, you know. Mm-hmm. And if you could say, oh, it's actually 1 euro, then you don't want this to happen. So depending on the game you're doing, you can choose one or the other, and they both have pros and cons, you know. So that's the first one. Yeah, the persistency. Yeah,
that's a thank you. That was a very clear explanation of the basics of the back end. But it seems like as of late, during the last decade, it's like more and more functionality has been added to the back end. And, you know, the teams, if it's an internal back-end development, have been growing significantly. And it's not only just making sure that people don't cheat or that they can play on multiple devices. It seems like almost every year there's new functionality added, especially if you've had your internal tech teams. They've been always eager to add anything from live ops capabilities to things that can boost even your marketing effort. So maybe going to Chris, like, how has it grown from what Rafa explained, kind of like the basics, the most important parts that we need from backends, to the sort of all-encompassing service from matchmaking to scalability to all these elements during the pretty much like last decade or so?
So it's a good question. I would say that the time I spent recently talking to some of the engineers at Activision King, they gave me this extremely useful representation of two different strategies around backend, right? You've got what we call solo plus meta. That's what Raphael's talked about. That information about your progression in the game world, it lives on the server, and the server decides rather than the client. Then you've got social plus meta. And I think what you're talking about, Mishka, is what we'd call social plus meta, right? Where it's not just about where the decision about progress for that player lives. It's about how to play with other players. Right, it might mean multiplayer. It might mean event leaderboards. It might be competitive features that might involve matchmaking. It might be friend lists and guild systems and social mechanics. All of those things, they lift the bar for what players are expecting year on year for what every game needs to include within it. And we've been on the cutting edge of helping studios with that for quite a while. And there are simply today very much some of the best games in the world. They will not, a new game coming into the market will not be as successful as those games without doing at least as much as they do. And they are always pushing the bar out on what we would call that social and competitive side. And you can't do that on client only, right? If you go to that solo plus meta, you could make the decisions happen on the client, but you can't, you know, you just can't build the kind of gameplay experiences without the server today that you see in some of the best games in the market.
Mm. Yeah, very, very much so. And the games have evolved quite significantly in the last 10 to 12 years, especially on mobile, like going from quite basic, you know, the Candy Crushes of the world to massively multiplayer titles.
If you take Candy Crush, that's your quintessential example of solo plus meta. If you take Toon Blast from Peak Games, that's your example of social plus meta. Right, they're both built around similar core game mechanics, but one is fundamentally about interacting with other players and grouping your progress together with other users online, and the other one has taken, probably because of its history in the market, a route towards that where now they're social, but they started with sort of solo and meta features first. Yeah. Mm.
And because the games have evolved, we have seen pretty much a massive rise of backends as a service. I've actually, you know, educated myself talking to and doing some surveys through Deconstructor Fund with dozens of CTOs and tech leads and asking them actually like how many of you are using backends as a service, and people were coming from multiple different sides of studios, from small indies to actually AAA studios. And what I found out is that the vast majority, if not almost everybody, not depending on the size of a studio, is using backend as a service. So my question is kind of like, what has caused this, where studios have willingly moved to outsource, essentially. Not outsource, but how would I put it? Yeah, like maybe it is an outsourcing of a backend.
Co-develop, maybe.
Yeah. Maybe starting with Rafa. I think, Rafa, you've worked both with the in-house backend as well as backend as a service.
Sorry for interrupting the podcast, but there's a couple of things I need to talk to you about. Data AI and Sensor Tower. Sensor Tower has acquired mobile analytics company Data AI, formerly known as AppAny. And there's four things you should know about this. Number one, significant advancements. This acquisition represents a major step forward for Sensor Tower. It expands its customer base, mobile marketing and app intelligent products, and global presence. Number two, undisputed leadership position. Through this acquisition, Sensor Tower strengthens its position as the leader in digital marketing and mobile app intelligence. Number three, combined insights. The merger with Data AI allows Sensor Tower to offer customers even stronger and more detailed insights on the digital customer journey. And number four, consumer trends. With increasing time spent on digital channels, the combined company is well positioned to capitalize on the growing trend of in-app purchases driven by platforms like Google, Meta, TikTok, YouTube, Instagram, and Snap. Exciting times lie ahead as Sensor Tower and Data AI join forces. If you are a customer, reach out to your account director for more information. If you're not a customer yet, you should schedule a call to explore the innovative digital marketing products they offer. Go to DataAI or to sensortower.com and get on board with undeniably best data partners in the business.
I wanted to talk to you about Heroic Labs. Building a successful game is hard enough without worrying about building your own game tech as well. Heroic Labs provides a comprehensive game stack to help you get your game into market faster and scale beyond the competition. With their Unity game framework Hero, you can cut development and prototyping time in half and quickly add social, economy, and reward systems to grow your game. Satori, the LiveOps platform built specifically for the games industry, lets you run live events, A/B tests, deliver dynamic content to players, and always keep your game growing. Nakama, the industry's leading open-source game server, lets you develop locally, providing all social and competitive features for your game, and then seamlessly transition to their Heroic Cloud-hosted service and easily scale to meet the largest of audience demands. Find out how to get started at heroiclabs.com.
Yes. What I think explains the rise is a couple of things, okay? One is there was also a rise in startups, indies, people that actually left big companies, you know, including you. Like you have been there, you left a company, you've built a startup, and there are many others who done this. You know, I have friends in Stockholm doing this, you know, right now, you know them. And when you are 3 to 5 people, you know, it's very hard to go from an in-house tool that you were used to work. But you can't just take that tool and use it because, you know, you don't have the rights to do that. And coming up with something from scratch, setting up a tech team, you know, creating everything from scratch for your first game is very time consuming. You need resources and you need to have people to maintain the tool. So that makes it much easier for startups to be focusing on the games. And most importantly, time to market is very important these days. If you have a new idea, you got to be really fast. You want to be the first. You know, you want to get the KPIs as early as you can. And you don't want to waste too much time with that infrastructure or creating all these. And once you have 2 or 3 games, you also need to have the people to handle these, you know, and to support your in-house tool in 2 or 3 games. So you make sure things don't break and, you know, and the tool you've built can scale. Because one of the first mistakes usual developers do is, I can build the best tool. I can do the you know, like it always feel like you can get something better. But the reality is some of these tools on the market, they have been there for many, many years, and all those years are learnings. So I think right now, companies like Bandai, you know, we are not small as a startup, but we are smart with our time. So we are focusing our resources into the game and what makes the game fun. And then we have, you know, tools as a service, like backend as a service to support us do those games as fast as we can and be able to scale.
Mm. Chris, what are the other elements that you're seeing are influencing the, you know, basically people becoming your clients?
So good question. I think Rafael hit an extremely strong point, which is that when you are a small team trying to compete, even with a huge amount of accumulated experience inside larger studios, you understand quite how large an undertaking it is to achieve the kind of infrastructure you need to be able to compete with some of the biggest games in the market. So how do you get there? You need to work with some kind of partner to do it. It makes the most sense. I think that's one element. I think the other element is that the industry is maybe going through a similar kind of journey that it did with game engines, right? For a decade or more, every studio built their own engine in-house, and they invested a huge amount internally. That was budgeted in, and that was worked out. And then as the requirements for engine development grew and the requirements for hardware, the capability of hardware grew, we ended up shifting in a direction where, well, there are partners in the space, you know, Unreal Engine, Unity Engine, who make this their entire job. And wouldn't it be better to be able to leverage that cumulative progress that they've made and build on top of it, rather than trying to build from scratch, catch up to them, and then own internally everything that goes on with the maintenance? What I call that total cost of ownership, of actually taking on that burden inside the studio. Mm. So I think that's kind of a similar direction that the rest of the industry is going in for kind of game tech, for server-based game tech.
Yeah, it makes all the sense. Like Rafael's kind of key word there was focus. So time, resources, everything that goes into that. And then understanding it's not only that you're going to build the back end and now you have it, but there's a lot of a maintenance. There's further building on it. And also focus means that, as Rafael, as you said, as a game studio, you need to be focusing on getting to market. And that means you need to focus on building the product. And that means you need to focus on iterating the core gameplay, iterating on the fun, and putting in, you know, the main efforts as game developers, not as you know, tech builders. And something that I've heard from other, you know, talking to other tech leads, like the challenge of an internal backend, if you want it to be competitive, is that the feature set is constantly evolving, and that means that you need to put more and more people on it, because as Chris, as you said, there's the element of not only the solo gameplay, but also the meta. So you have to put in those, and the socials, the leaderboards, the guilds, the matchmaking, like you name it. Like, those elements are constantly evolving, and they're coming more and more of those, so you need to be putting them as well. And I'm curious to ask is, like, how important are the elements of cross-platform play, scalability, having all these analytics sets? Like, are those important for when you're looking at backends as a service? Maybe Chris, as you are involved with many clients.
Good question. I think the analytics side of the problem space is something that it is its own domain that needs solving, right? I think any centralized set of tooling that tries to solve too many problems at once, especially in a single product, is just going to end up doing somewhere a disservice to what you really need, especially in the sophistication that you expect in the games industry. So I think analytics is its own problem space, sort of the aggregating the UA data, putting it into a data lake, analyzing monetization efforts, introducing live ops systems and how they interact with those monetization efforts are almost a domain problem of their own. And then you've got that core infrastructure, the game backend itself that Rafael mentioned, that covers persistence. You've mentioned social, you've mentioned multiplayer, that are their own problem spaces. So I would say that solving them all, unfortunately, is necessary to reach escape velocity in the industry today. But solving them all in one place and expecting them all to be done to the highest standard is going to be difficult to find. And I think for us, the way that we solve these problems are we dig down into specific areas, the core back end, what we think of as core infrastructure. We solve those problems, and then we move to solving other problems in different products, in different tools, because it won't all fit in one place, in my humble opinion.
Hmm. Understood. Rafael, do you have something to add, or should we start talking about disadvantages of backend as a service?
We can start on the disadvantages. Yes.
Well, let's talk about it. So you, having worked with both, what are the disadvantages when you have an external service provider in this critical part of your studio?
Yes, I think the biggest disadvantage, and you know, we talked in between the coders at Bandai, is ownership of the code. Being able to have access to source code, you know, being able to customize things if needed. Not all of the providers have source code available, and this can be a deal breaker for many of the, you know, bigger studios with that comes from, you know, in-house tools, and so owning the source code, having access to it, it's really important. With Nakama, it's open source, so we were very confident of the quality. You also have a community, you know, looking at the code as well as you are. So the source code is one of the disadvantages. The next one for us that was pretty high on the list was customer support and response time. How fast can I talk to someone and they can understand my problem and we can fix it? Because when you're developing a game and you're not live, you can take as much time as you need. Once you have a game that is making, you know, 100K a day or more, you have like a top grossing game, and there is something broken, you need to be very fast, you know. So that jumps into the service agreements and resolving issues. Every provider have different tiers and pricing. If you want them to reply in 2 hours or 24 hours or 48 hours, you know. So depending on who you are dealing with, you know, and the contract you chose, it can be pretty slow or it can be very fast, you know, and you have to balance the cost with the speed and consider if some of these are deal breakers for you, and it highly depends, you know, provider to provider. So this is our take was basically this: ownership, source code, customer support, and getting things fixed fast if needed.
How about things like feeling that you're locked in to a service provider, because this is an essential service. I feel like it's not a plug and play to just switch a back end service provider. Like, is there a fear of dependency?
Yes, there was one tool, I don't remember the name, that it was a complete black box. So that means I don't know anything that is happening there. I have no access. I can't really take over and continue. So if they go bankrupt or if they get acquired, you know, or if they shut down, I wouldn't be able to do anything. I would have to find another partner and do the whole integration, you know, and we can talk more about this later. But basically, yes, when we chose to go with Heroic Labs, we knew that because the base server is open source, it's ours. So even if they go out of the game, we can continue our own game without having to change dramatically, you know? So yes, this was on our list for sure.
And finally, like when you're thinking about costs, like how are you, so you talked about the cost of customer support versus the speed of customer support, but overall, when you're thinking about the cost of backend, is it, like, again, talking to a lot of tech leads, like what I understood that even though the service providers like Heroic and others are very transparent in how what the cost is, in the end, the size of your game, the size of the live operation, the amount of calls, like how server heavy it is, will play a significant role in the overall cost of your game. And so I'm wondering, is like how big of an element the cost is?
We did many spreadsheets, with the cost of, you know, you have 1 million DAU, 2 million, 3 million. So to us, the pricing today, you know, of the market now, they were pretty competitive. They were pretty fair that you can make a top 100 game and still have a reasonable cost. You know, I think the advantage of saving cost will come long term, but this is going to come when you're very successful. You know, you're not going to feel that before you're hitting, you know, I know, let's say 100 million a year. So you got to have quite a lot of success to be able to, you know, and more than one game to say, yes, we're saving a lot. So for us, the advantages, they were much bigger than the hit we would have with cost. You know, it wouldn't make or break our game because of that cost, because they are pretty fair these days.
So Chris, when you're talking to potential new clients, like what are these elements that they bring in as potential disadvantages in backend as a service?
So cost estimation is tricky. Rafael did mention that you typically do need to spreadsheet it out. We will help game teams with that problem as well, help build them a cost estimation model that fits the kind of MAU or DAU or CCU, depending on the game type that they're looking to build. And that kind of gives them a stronger sense of where the cost moves as they scale. So that's important. Depending on who you talk to that's providing game tech, some of the cost estimation modeling can be really hard. I mean, we strive to be as simple as possible, but some of it can, the devil is so in the details that you're unsure how you could possibly know ahead of time how some of that cost is going to materialize. But Raphael's right that I think generally the market is doing the right thing, going in the right direction on that front. I do think that when you're evaluating a game backend, I think something that can often be perceived as a disadvantage, but it's just difficult to figure out in general, is you have what I call known unknowns and unknown unknowns, right? So when you're kind of at that phase, you know, we could refer to it as window shopping. You're at that phase of, you have some sense of what your game is going to be. But like any creative process, it's going to morph and change over time, right? As you try to find the fun, right? Try to find that sweet spot that players are going to love playing. And as you do that, you have a sense of what you're looking for that you know you need. And then what you don't know yet is things that you might need in the future. And that might be where you get tripped up later, right? You start working with some kind of game tech provider. They have what you need today, and you hope it will evolve fast enough with you. And depending on who you're working with, it might not. It might be a very tricky proposition. And then later, how flexible is where you're at to be able to bolt something else on to achieve that outcome, bolt some other feature on that they couldn't otherwise provide to you. So that can be very tricky. Yeah, I think that's one of the things that comes up what we speak to studios about, is they look for this as wide a pool of things to be solved for them from day one immediately now, because they're just so worried about what direction they might need to morph in. And it makes sense. It's a creative process.
Yeah, that's the part of the customization and how important it is as you move forward.
Yes.
Hey game devs, are you tired of dealing with complicated payment processes all over the world? Well, Xsolla's got your back with Xsolla PayStation. It has a simple, user-friendly interface that makes it easy for players to pay for your games and in-game content however they want. And because the Xsolla PayStation user interface is adaptive and accessible on smartphones, tablets, and PCs, your players will have a seamless experience no matter their preferred device. Players can save their favorite payment methods for future purchases, and on mobile, even charge purchases directly to their phone carrier bill. On the back end, you can customize your checkout with game-specific integration options like sidebars and iframes, as well as change colors, fonts, and images to make PayStation look and feel like a natural part of your game. Ready to see Xsolla's PayStation in action? Visit xsolla.pro/payments-dof or visit the link in this podcast description. The games industry is experiencing unprecedented growth, with global revenues projected to reach a staggering $268 billion by 2025. But with more players than ever connecting across platforms and devices, how can your game stand out against the competition? AppsFlyer has created AppsFlyer for Games to help you unlock your players' true LTV by providing a wealth of game measurement solutions, unique industry insights, and proven best practices. Our dedicated hub is packed with innovative products, industry partnerships, and unrivaled expertise to ensure your game game brand adapts and thrives. We understand that every game is unique, and AppsFlyer's data-driven insights allow us to cater to your specific needs. We know that in today's evolving landscape, staying ahead of the curve is crucial. Trust in AppsFlyer for Games to guide you through this exciting journey. We have the tools, the knowledge, and the passion to help you succeed in this ever-expanding landscape. Together, we'll conquer new worlds, both real and fantasy, break records, and create gaming experiences that leave a lasting impact. Get in touch with AppsFlyer for Games today and unleash your game's true potential. AppsFlyer for Games, supercharging the gaming landscape.
This is actually interesting. So, you know, in the news, we've seen a lot of games having challenges when they're scaling nowadays, especially on AAA front. And I was wondering, and again, not only wondering, just talking to a lot of tech leads and trying to understand where these come from, because it's so easy to, in the end, say that, oh, it was the problem with our back-end service provider. But to my understanding, when we're talking about these big projects, it takes years and years to actually go from idea to concept to playable to actually shipping and scaling that game. How important it is to keep that dialogue with your back-end service provider, because what you had in your design document, you know, having been at game studios for about 15 years, is pretty much never what you ended up shipping. And so when you design your back-end to answer those questions and support that game, that's actually a different game that finally may launch and begin scaling. So how do you kind of like avoid these type of problems that occur throughout the production?
So for us, we try to be as involved as we can with the game team as early as possible. We just simply try to offer as much time as we can, because as you say, things are going to change, things are going to evolve. And the more we can be a partner to the studio, where we're operating more like an extension of the development team than simply a vendor who you communicate with for support tickets, right? You know, the closer we can be to the studio team, the better sense we get ahead of time on the direction they might be taking, some approach they're taking to matchmaking or something else, and try to sort of advise or steer or adapt as we need to. That's quite hard. We find it quite difficult because some game teams, they don't really want to talk to engineers who are not in the studio team. So we actually find that a bit difficult at times to be able to help. But that's what we would prefer to do as much as possible, wherever we can. We'd love for studio teams to see us as an extension of their team in a way that means that we can help them. When they evolve their ideas and morph what they're building, make sure that we can help steer it to the way that we have seen work with our game tech. Yeah,
Rafa, have you seen this as a challenge where what you were building is not exactly what the end product that you're going to ship, and then that information hasn't been portrayed to the back end, whether internal or external team, and so problems are starting to arise there, or even the costs are higher because it was designed in a different way than it was originally thought about?
Yes, like, it's very hard to predict what is going to happen at scale. You know, when, like, it's only experience that allow you to have a gut feeling of, you know, potential issues. So as a programming team, you really do your best to make applications both on the client, you know, your computer or your phone, but also on the backend. But despite having some tools to do extensive, you know, load testing where you throw millions of requests and you see if everything is going well, certain things are just gonna be learned when you're live, you know. So for AAA, it's really complex. If your game is very hyped, you know, like Blizzard games and all these games that are in day one, you have several millions of players playing the game at the exact same time. So that is a much bigger challenge than a mobile game, where these days the scale is very slow. You know, you release a game in a country, you have technical launches, your UA campaign, you know, the money you put is what brings the traffic. So you're very unlikely a company is going to spend, you know, so many millions in UA, so you have so much players that you can't handle. So on mobile, is much controllable, and you can, you know, scale and you can react and you can fix things. On AAA, yes, it's very hard. Even Blizzard has been having issues. You know, they've done this since 2004 on World of Warcraft, and every new game you have server issues. So there is no answer to that. It's like, it's you do the best to prevent it, but at that scale, it can break things because millions of people are different than a few hundreds, you know, playtesting your game.
Mm. And Chris, what actions should, like, you of course you work with, I don't even know how many clients, but I would assume
hundreds.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's impossible to be in tune with so many, and that's why you have the open source approach and so forth. But how do you, like, what could be the ways to mitigate the issue that may arise by the studio not communicating with the back end of the service provider before it becomes an issue? Like is there perhaps some kind of a design meetings in advance?
I think design overall is the place that we strive for. I think you're absolutely right. For us, we've tried to design our technology such that to as large an extent as possible, the way you use it, it's opinionated, right? The way you use it means that you will land into the most successful outcome. The outcome where you didn't have to think about the scaling conditions, the locking impact, the, you know, performance implications of when you're live for using that feature. So we've strived to design at a technical level the structure of the code that a studio writes so that they have less to think about when they're actually ending up scaling in production. So that's one route that we take. The other route is we've seen a lot of different types of games. We've worked on a lot of different games, sort of matching, merging, grand strategy, mid-core RPG. We worked on a lot of different game genres. And so we have been able to see a lot of different emergent patterns at scale in those games. And that just gives us an opportunity to know that even within a particular genre of game design that a studio is working in, the core mechanic might change, but we've seen the genre enough to know what scaling patterns end up emerging, and we can actually help them get the right fit for that.
Yeah, understood. Okay. Well, let's talk about in-house backend. So what are the advantages of having an in-house? Because, you know, everything is there. So Rafa, you've worked with both. Talk to me about in-house.
Yes. So in-house at Rovio, they had this tool called Beacon, you know, which mm-hmm. is the in-house backend as a service. The biggest advantages is you are owner of the entire code base. So you have nobody to ask for anything. You own everything. So this is one of the big advantages. Everything you do is within your company and you don't depend on anyone. The other one is case by case, again, because, you know, at Rovio, you have a central tech that needs to support multiple games. So I was working on Angry Birds 2. If the game is doing good revenue and you have an issue, and the issue is not in the game, but is in the central tech, you raise a ticket and it's all hands on deck. You know, everyone is going to jump on this immediately because you don't want to lose money. You're literally losing hundreds of thousands a day and you want to fix this as fast as you can. So you give priority as you wish. If you have a smaller game with less revenue, maybe your central tech team is not going to need to react that fast, you know. So this is also something that being in-house, it's quite easy to reach people and just like fix and debug issues. And the other one, I think, as an advantage is the whole thing with data privacy and security. Some companies are very strict. Some companies, they do not want anyone holding the data of their clients. And this, I would say, is the biggest deal breaker for many of the big companies where they have either some legal things, you know, they must be in charge, or they have very high security standards where they don't trust a partner to do this. So in terms of advantages, is this. In these advantages is kind of the opposite, you know, as we talked before, extra time to actually maintain and create it, extra people, you need cloud engineers, you need central backend engineers, and you need to invest a significant amount of money to reach a level where this is useful and this is, you know, very good for multiple games.
When you're hiring talent, programmers especially, is having an internal backend a plus or a minus?
It depends quite a lot. In the past, people, they were really interested in joining companies to have access to in-house technology and learn from those tools, you know. These days, there's quite a lot of people, you know, especially with layoffs in the industry. You have studios that are laying off by hundreds and thousands, and those people were working sometimes in in-house things that they do not have in another company. So there are many developers that want to be doing Unity, Unreal, you know. So I think with the backend as a service, as it grows, as it gets, you know, to a level where it's like Unity, it's used by thousands of developers, the trend is going to be, oh, I want to work with this kind of tool, you know, because that will allow me to switch jobs or find a new job and transfer my knowledge, you know. So it depends on the developer, but I think there is a trend to be using cross platform and cross studio technologies.
Chris, what have you seen that are sort of like advantages of internal backend system when comparing, for example, to your services?
So I think Raphael hit on most of them. What is interesting that a lot of those positives can also have that double-edged sword of being negatives as well. You know, a lot of studios and particularly publishers that we've worked with, they have a central tech team. They have a central tech team. There is a collection of microservices internally. This is their pool of internal APIs that any game team can pick up and adopt. But then the ability to modify those things, adapt it to something that is going to be a new game project and maybe even a new genre of game that they're going to be experimenting in, becomes a lot harder because you're talking about changing something that now has a lot of other games or teams depending on the way it currently works today. So you actually get this slowdown over time with the way that an internal team is able to rapidly make change and support a larger number of games of different genres as the studio and publisher grows. So, but I think Raphael hit the positives, is that if you want total control over every aspect of the development process, you have the time and the budget to be able to do that. You have perhaps a more focused or more limited set of genres that you want to target, maybe even a limited set of platforms that you want to go after, mobile versus, say, you know, hybrid, you know, cross-play type gameplay experiences, then it can work. It can definitely work. There are plenty of teams that are doing it, but there is a trade-off to all of that. Mm. Yeah.
And so, well, backend, like building your own backend is a considerable investment, as I've said, and it's not only an investment upfront, but it's ongoing investment. So you're looking for a return for that type of investment. And sometimes what I've heard quite often from the tech leads is they're saying it makes sense if it gives you core competence in a specific genre. They often would say MMORPG being the primary genre where they would be very serious about actually building their own backend versus using a third service provider. What does that mean in practice? Like, why MMORPG, and what does a core competence in internal backend mean in practice? So
I'll pick this one up. MMORPG is probably one of those areas where I completely agree, where you've got the simulation server running the game state authoritatively with large numbers of concurrent players online interacting with each other. And how that simulation binds to the physics inside the game world, how it means, you know, how it plays out for the good, kind of the quality and the feel of the gameplay experience and the latency of communication for players. All of those things have a massive impact on the overall player experience of that game type. And so I think building tooling and technology that's core to the studio in that area is definitely something every studio is going to do. And I can't see that particularly changing. Okay. But what's interesting is that you can still think about the collection of services that go around that core simulation, the inventory systems, the friends list, the guild systems. And actually, if you step back a little, a lot of those features and APIs and those functions of the game world are quite common to what you'd see and interact with in other games. So what I would tend to suggest when studios are thinking about sort of that MMO landscape, you're definitely going to be building your own infrastructure and server-based simulation systems for running these kind of distributed gameplay. But consider not building everything, because engineers like to build. And once you get halfway in, they just want to go all the way and build everything. And if you take a more measured, perhaps a hybrid approach to that problem, a little bit of internal tech, a little bit of a partner of some kind on the game tech side, you probably ship a game, an MMO game, faster than anyone does in the market. And as Raphael mentioned, speed to market is really important.
And one thing that I want to touch upon what Raphael said was the privacy. So when you own everything, you are the owner of your own data, and that is very important for, I would assume, every studio, especially the larger ones that are more prone to hacking. How do external backend service providers, like what is the way to assure them that you are in ownership of your data? Like, do they get their own service, their own environments, or like what is the way to answer to that need?
So the way we solve that is we don't run a multi-tenant service. When you are storing your game data, it is stored in your own environment in much the same way that you described. These servers, the hardware itself is not being shared with anybody else. Okay, nothing on the disk is being shared. No player account information is being shared. There's no crossover, right? They're entirely isolated, sandboxed from each other, right? That's the first piece of it. The second piece of it, I think, is that we have the opportunity, because of the way we distribute our game tech, to run it anywhere. So we don't have to run it on our Google Cloud or AWS account for you, right? We can run it inside your account as well, in which case we can adopt and conform to whatever information security policies get mandated within that studio or publisher. So we can meet those requirements. So I think that helps a lot. And I think generally, because of things like the EU Data Directive and mandates around Privacy Shield and things like that, and the way players own their own data, even if it's remotely stored by a company, means that all of these things are tightening up anyway from a privacy perspective. And as the privacy portion tightens up, the security model around it tightens up anyway.
Thank you. Makes sense. All right, let's talk about disadvantages of your own backend. So, Rafa, you know, we've said multiple times that the cost and the ongoing investment is part of that. But what other disadvantages have you experienced when working with internal backend as a service?
In the end, it's a similar problem, because despite me working on Angry Birds, okay, I was owner, and I'm talking about knowledge. I knew the Angry Birds part of the code base, you know? So you know the game-specific stuff. The in-house, it's still something you don't know. So the company owns, but I still, you know, I need someone. In my case, I was in Stockholm. I needed the guys in Finland to actually do things when needed, you know? So the ownership, and I think we need to clarify here that the backend, we are still building a backend, okay? It's not that you go with a backend as a service provider and you're just doing client work. So right now at Bandai, we are doing a game. It's, you know, we're producing a game. I would say we are 50-50. 50% of our backend is written by us. We are actually doing features, talking to designers, you know, But as we keep on developing and as the game grows and as we have live ops, and I can easily see our entire backend being 70-80% our own game specific things, and then the 30% is the service, you know, which is facilitating the other 80%. So you as a game, despite using in-house or a provider, you still have to write code, you still have to put the game logic in your own game, you know, you have to design the rules. So you have quite a lot of code that is your own, and the provider is just the 20-30% that makes everything, you know, fit together nicely and reusable.
Got it. And something that I've, so of course I don't have experience directly with the backends, but something that I've experienced as a product manager with analytics systems, so using internal versus external, maybe a little bit of a different comparison, but with analytics, when using an external services, I always felt that they were more polished, they were easier to use, they were thought about from the user perspective. And then again, whenever we ended up using our internal analytics tools, they were never quite as robust, and they lacked a lot of features that I would have wished to have. Does this type of thing happen with internal backend development, where you're like, well, we were just using this other service that is, you know, actually sold to clients, and now we have this internal version, and I have to ask for tickets, and my game and perhaps is not the biggest one in portfolio, and things are just not looking as, you know, as nice?
Yes, definitely. Like, you sometimes you're forced to use the in-house tool, knowing that there is a better analytics. You know, Chris said before, no company will tackle all problems. So with us, you know, we have chosen another provider for analytics, dashboards. So yes, if you have in-house and everything is mandatory to go through the in-house, you're also putting quite a lot of limitations on what your engineers can do. And maybe your in-house is not moving as fast as the market. You know, these providers, they are fully dedicated to do these, and they have hundreds of clients. So the improvements they will do will very likely be much faster and better than your in-house tool. So yes, definitely this can be a drawback and even a limitation.
Got it. And Chris, what other disadvantages have you seen when using an internal backend service versus an external one?
Let's see. So I can't speak to the customer, but I know from a lot of the engineers who we work with at some of the larger publishers, they experience a lot of resistance from even their own central tech teams. They simply put it on the backlog. It might happen one day, but there's a lot of competing priorities. And things get left behind because, you know, Raphael mentioned that, you know, priority zero, critical issues will get resolved exceptionally quickly. But when things can't be communicated as though they are critical issues, because they aren't, right? They might be, you know, a new direction that the game is going in. They just get treated very differently because there's so much pressure on that small pool of engineering resource internally that things have to get... something has to give, and it is usually something that affects the game team's bigger direction they want to take the project in. It can act as a blocker on that progress.
Mm. We talked about, you know, the provider may be going bankrupt, but what if your central tech engineers leave the company? Like, imagine you have five people, and two or three of them leave at the same time. It's going to be a big hit, you know, so this is also something that in-house has to deal with, and it can also be a disadvantage. You don't have the knowledge replacement that fast. So that's also one thing to think about.
Mm. Let's move on to discussing, like, when your CTO, tech lead, backend lead are making the decision of using a backend as a service, you know, how is this decision made? Like, what are those important elements? Like, I know how decisions are made with other services that go through. But it was always, to me, a black box on how we ended up choosing a certain backend, especially because I have relationships with certain backend as a service companies. And I would say, hey, maybe we should use this service. And I would get an answer like, no, we're going to go to a different direction without even a conversation. And I would also know people from other backend as a service companies who would tell me, don't use that. I work there and it's not worth it. They're not supporting, let's say, mobile. They are moving to a different direction. Trust me, I was there. Don't go there. And then I would have a tech leader would say, no, we're going to go there. I've used them before. It's fine. I know there's drawbacks, but it's the service that I know. So let's just go with that one. There's no much difference. So I was always in this situation where I didn't know how the decision is being made, but I was nevertheless who would pay for that decision in terms of the cost. So maybe Rafa, starting with you, is like, how are these decisions to choose one backend over another made?
Cool. Yeah. At Bandai, we don't really have a CTO in Barcelona because we have this flatter structure. But we do have three principal engineers that we basically, I'm one of them. We basically do a short list. So we do a research and see everything that is out there. And we come up with, let's say, a top three or top five candidates. Then each one of us actually go through, download the tool, do the whole integration. And we actually want to develop a little feature. We want to do something, that you would potentially do in a game. It could be upgrading a character. It could be, consuming some duplicates, some coins, something simple. You wanna look at your setup, how easy it was from downloading it, installing, and then, booting the server, running this, in a continuous integration system where the builds are being built, automatically. And you go and you document pros and cons on each of these. You also say, it's open source. It's not open source. We have access. We don't have access. Customer support. So we do these with, 3 to 5 candidates. We have it documented. And basically, we go in a room with the engineers and we start talking, discarding. Let's remove three of them. And then we have two finalists. Mm-hmm. So we start to back and forth cost. We also have to talk with the head of studio, because he is the one that is going to pay for the cost. So we got to say, look, maybe we like this one. It has, let's say, 10-20% more expensive, but in the end, this is going to be. So there is a mix of engineering, things where you want to make sure that you can debug and you can work very fast. You want to develop features very fast, but also you need to talk to the stakeholders that that will provide you the financials to make sure, like, okay, we're willing to pay this, we understand the cost. So for us, we did exactly this for, I would say, about a month and a half that we took to dive deep into a few until we chose to partner with Nakama, and we had these, conversations with our head of studio, with the game leads, and so on, so on. So this is overall, a CTO would never do this by himself. If he's smart, he should have a team of engineers and then come up with a decision,
So it takes a good while, and it takes time from your lead programmers or lead engineers. So that's not cheap. That's they should be building the product, but now they're doing this work. How do you get that short list? Like you said, you start off with five. How did you pick up the five?
Well, it's a mix of going through the promises. Okay. So the first thing is, do not trust marketing material, because everything on a web page is always beautiful. It's always perfect. They will never tell about the problems. Nobody will advertise issues. So I did talk with some people that, had worked with different tools, and I said, look, did you work with these? What was your experience, pros and cons? So I did consult with two or three colleagues in the industry and got their feedback about one of those. But in the end, you know, you need to do some research, see what is there, look at the promises and see if they actually deliver on those promises. But yeah, the short list is a mix of what is there, asking people, and then you have to do the work. That 1 month or a month and a half, it pays off because you will be stuck with that for a very long time. So you don't want to take it wrong.
Got it. So references over any marketing, that's clear. So you're basically getting your checklist from other engineers in your network, and they will give you, hey, you should check this one out and that one out, and we tested them, but they weren't for us, but you could test them again. And that builds your list of 3 to 5 services that you're going to test against each other. And then the second part that you mentioned is you talk to the stakeholders, game leads, as well as head of studio, who only says, how much is this? And then you give them a ballpark number that is going to be so obscure that nobody should trust that number in any way, because it's dependent on so many things. Nevertheless, you talk to the stakeholders to understand what are they looking from the back end, and then you comply a list of things you're testing against. Is that correct?
Yes. And I also forgot the service agreement with your legal team is also, it takes a while. So you want to make sure that everything in your legal department, you know, understands the things, what happens if they go bankrupt, if they get acquired, you know, like all these transactions. Mm-hmm. You need someone else to do that. So yeah, this was also one of the rest is you're correct.
Got it. So that all of these stakeholders, legal team being one of them, is going to be part of or their requirements is going to be part of the what are you testing against when you're looking at these different service providers. You said a couple of times during this podcast, like, what happens if, you know, if the back-end service gets acquired or gets shut down or whatever it is. How high up is that on? Or actually, let me put it this way. A lot of these backends as a service providers, like if I take GameSpark and PlayFab, that's Amazon and Microsoft. So I would say they are relatively secure. I don't see neither Amazon or Microsoft going bankrupt anytime soon. Most other, like pretty much everybody else is a startup. I mean, venture funded oftentimes. Is that a risk that the legal team views, or like how is it? Just out of curiosity.
Yes, that is pretty high. That is actually a deal breaker. And if we cannot come with an agreement, if you know the agreement is not maybe customizable to your needs, if it's, you know, this is what we do and it's exactly the same for every client and we're not budging on changing any of these, it is going to be hard, you know. So it's a negotiation, and there is clauses that you can, you know, discuss with the providers to handle those situations. So it is possible to have that in contracts, what happens if you get acquired, you know. So it's case by case, but it in the end, it was the last deal breaker thing for us, to a point that if we couldn't come up with an agreement, we would say, well, we're going to have to do it ourselves. So
And that's why access to the source code is so important, because it's a fail safe for a studio in case this type of a thing could happen. And it, and also one thing that I've heard of, and like this is in almost in every business, is like if you are the CTO who makes the decision on the back end, they would say, well, you can never go wrong by choosing Microsoft or Amazon, even though you did the wrong choice. It was not the right back end, maybe not nearly as robust as a more newer from a startup would be. But nevertheless, nobody could say to you afterwards, like, well, why did you choose that over them? It's like you can always say on the security excuse. And I was just curious, because that is something that I've heard, and that is something in my own experience when we were going through a lot of different backends, is like this sort of a security of a big company played a role. But Chris, like, what are you hearing when you talk with potential clients and the existing clients? Like, what are the worries that they bring forward when going through the selection process?
So from our experience, the biggest point of friction is scaling, actually. It's usually not necessarily, I mean, I think it helps because of our open source approach to core infrastructure. I think we probably have less conversations about what it looks like in terms of access to source code in some kind of eventuality, right? So for us, a lot of it is scaling. And that means simulations, benchmarking, throughput testing, that kind of stuff. And we have a lot of existing examples of having done that with real games. And so that's how we tend to navigate that one. Just help them see just by what is in production today with game teams who use Narkoma. And then through that, they can understand what they can expect from the system at scale.
Are there any elements... are there any elements that come in like as the most important when studios are reviewing backend? Like, I know we talked about the sort of a safety being one, but are there other elements that you keep hearing that is like on the forefront when choosing a backend?
As I mentioned before, you've got the feature mapping, as I tend to refer to it, that you're thinking about the type of game that you're building. The type of meta you want to provide to players. Is it social? Is it solo play first? And then think about how that affects what amount of code might need to be developed by the studio team themselves. Just as Raphael mentioned, you will, no matter what game tech you build on, you will be building tooling and tech on top of it. It's just the nature of any software development. So with that in mind, they'll start there, transition to scaling, and then I think Raphael's right. I think in some conversations that others have had with the market, it will be what happens in sort of change of ownership events or things like that. For us, we tend to see less of that. And then I guess the last piece of it is then pricing, really, because as Raphael mentioned, a lot of the market is kind of converging to a stable point on price at a level of scale anyway. Yeah. Mm.
Got it. Well, last question is something that I've also experienced in job is switching backend. And there's been situations where, let's say in a few different ways. Like one is when you're building a game and the game from original design keeps changing, and during the development there is a window, because it's not live yet, it's not in full-fledged production, where the backend team wants to actually change the backend service provider, because the initial choice done by somebody else is maybe not as flexible. Maybe it's one of those safe choices, aka black boxes, that are not actually answering to what this game needs to deliver. And the other part where I've seen and why I find this so interesting is in acquisitions. So sometimes going through an acquisition and the acquirer is looking at the acquired company, and then they're seeing how they could grow this game with much more improved this portfolio with much more improved life services and more effective product management, user acquisition, modern ways of running games. And as they're going through and even have gone through an acquisition, they only then realize that somebody has made a very safe choice in terms of backends, implemented a black box solution that is actually not functioning with their services. And so they have to go through a process of changing backends, which can last up to a year or even a year and a half as they replace these backends. And suddenly the whole acquisition is not performing as they intended, because they can't even get to work and start operating the games like they want to. So I've seen kind of like these backend services bite the business targets because they were just not surfaced or wasn't even thought about. And it was like, what? I didn't even know this was a thing. So going to my question is like, how do you switch a backend, and then like what goes into that thinking of like now we have to switch our backend as a service. So Rafael, maybe we start with you.
Yes, what you said is pretty accurate. You know, like if you're having services shutdowns, persistent issues, you know, you're having these over and over, or your game team is slow. Like your engineers are saying, it's taking us too much time. You know, there is quite a lot of things. It's a slow process to use this tool, or you have some legal reasons, you know, something came up, new legislations or compliances. All of these are pretty valid, you know, things to consider a switch. If your game is live, it's much harder. It's much more challenging to go from some A to B. So my recommendation, you know, and the way I would do this is in phases. So you try to break down your game into parts and see if you can transition one thing at a time. You know, maybe you have a service that have analytics and some other, you know, inventory management and some other things. And then you say, okay, let's do the analytics first. So you do that transition, it takes some time, you go live. Or sometimes you can even run the game with two servers. So you have the original provider and then the new one, and you can slowly get some players, you know, and you can transfer this to your newly built in-house tool or your next provider. So you have to be very cautious, because you don't want to break a live game, you know, and then your revenue is dropping or your retention is not there because people are having more issues with the new thing. So it is possible. It should be reserved for more extreme situations. So if you can avoid it, it's better. You know, it's not like, oh, the new engineer joined, he doesn't like it, he likes the other one, you know, but that is not really a good excuse. So, and you will have to deal with this. You will have to hear engineering say, I don't like the way this is done. You know, I think the other one is better, but that is not really an extreme situation for a live game.
Mm. So to understand correctly, when you have a live game, it kind of is what it is. And you can switch a backend from a live game, but it's going to be very costly. It will take a lot of time, and you will only do it in extreme situations where, as you said, there's limitations on scalability. There might be severe performance issues, you know, that kind of stuff, or the company's acquired or getting shut down and so forth. But when you are in early phases of development, switching a backend is more possible. And that's why I think the previous conversation is important, because I feel like it's very, because it's so much easier to do it early hand and you can avoid so many mistakes down the pipe, you should really focus on making the right choice from the beginning rather than trying to fix something, because this is a very tough issue to fix when it's actually on the live game. And it can make or even break your business case if you have made the wrong choice because you didn't just deem it as important early on. But Chris, kind of like, have you gone through or have you worked with companies that have switched their backends and switched to Heroic from whatever they were using before?
Yeah, we've actually done quite a few of those, strangely enough. The largest one we've worked on is making about $190 million in annual revenue. So it was a big game. It took almost 2 years.
Wow.
To transition it over. But obviously because of the revenue and opportunity and future plans that they had for the game made it very much worth doing it. It felt a little bit like trying to replace the engine, wheels, shell of a car while it's still on the road racing on the racing track. So it's a big endeavor and you have to get every single edge case right. So it's a tricky one. The other motivation that we've seen that studios will move back end, some kind of internal legacy tech where some of the internal team have gone And so they simply have new engineers coming in who just don't know how a large portion of the code works, how even a lot of it is still running at that point. And they just need to transition off it. They need to take something new, and they need to go somewhere more modern, and that they involve us. I think you do need a very hands-on approach to make that work, because I don't think the engineering team internally, if they're going to a game tech partner, are going to be able to buy reviewing just the internal back and forth between the client and the server side of the code is going to figure out every edge case. I think you're going to need to involve somebody on the game tech partner side to help make that happen. But yeah, we've done more than 24 of them for significant games that was worth doing that for. Yeah, but it's not a quick process. And I don't think anyone who tells you it is telling you something that's truthful, really, at this point. There's too many unknown unknowns that are just legacy to the way that the system is then running. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Nobody has ever said that it's simple. Most often it's the reason not to change a backend and rather suffer with a much worse option. But of course, in cases where you can see the potential of the game, or if it's already showing its potential, it can be even larger, and they still undergo a process of 2 years of changing a backend. That's insane. So that's how bad the previous backend was. That they were like, fine, we'll just eat a 2 year cost of saving of changing the chassis and the tires while the car is driving full clip. So the way I'm hearing it is like there must have been serious problems with their initial backend choice to undergo such a massive operation. And that's why it's important to really discuss these benefits and the drawbacks of both external and internal backends so that you make this choice early and you make it properly, not based on, well, I know this backend, so I'm just going to work with it, or it's not as simple, we'll figure it out later down the line. It's like, no. You have to be incredibly measured and put the work in the diligence of choosing your backend, even though it sounds like not the most important part because you're building the product at that point. You have to live with it.
The internal stakeholder that we worked with on this particular project, he was widely referred to as a maverick inside the studio because they expected it would not work. They expected it was going to be too hard to do. Yeah. It can be that big an undertaking.
Yeah. Insane.
But they're very happy now.
Well, I would be very happy with where they started with the run rate of almost 200 million a year. That sounds like a happy team.
Yeah.
So thank you for, a ton of information on backends for people like myself who have very limited understanding of it and who have only seen the issues of a backend not functioning as it should. And I hope this podcast gives founders, directors, executives, a little bit more tools on when having this conversation. So it's not only a question about which one is cheaper, but more questions more about what type of questions you should ask your team who's making the selection and making sure that they don't take the comfortable option, but they actually do the due diligence and test different options. And as well, keep communicating, whether with its internal backend team or external backend as a service, as they are developing the game, so that the issues won't arise when it actually launches and starts scaling because they haven't updated on their initial plans. So on that sounds note, thank you so much, Rafael. Thank you so much, Chris, for all
thank
the
you,
all
Mishka.
The knowledge and all the insights. And that's a wrap.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the whole episode. If you like this podcast, please do leave a comment and share the episode. If you want to access the Deconstructor of Fun community with hundreds of senior games folk, go to our website and apply to the Slack group. And if you want to get notified of all the new content we have coming out every week, do subscribe to the weekly Deconstructor of Fun newsletter. Finally, do remember, we love you guys and we appreciate you guys. Catch you next time.